Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in the next 2 half-hour segments, we're going to be updating a subject that I've been covering for many years and a particular focus on that particular subject over many years, namely Germany and the reemergence of German fascism. We're going to begin by taking a look at growing evidence of intelligence conflicts between the United States and Germany in the wake of the end of the Cold War. This is a subject that I've discussed in For the Record segment 119, among other programs. We're going to take a look now at the San Francisco Chronicle of Thursday, September 30th of 1999. This is a Washington Post story by William Drozdiak, D-R-O-Z-D-I-A-K. It's headlined, CIA Withdraws 3 CIA Agents from Germany, subtitled Tension Over U.S. Intelligence Gathering. It's state-lined Berlin, and it reads in part as follows. The United States has recalled 3 CIA agents at Germany's insistence in a fresh sign of tension between the two allies over the scale and purpose of U.S. intelligence gathering in Germany. The repatriation of the 3 Americans, described as a married couple and their supervisor working undercover out of the U.S. consulate in Munich, came after they were accused of using false pretenses to recruit German citizens for unspecified economic espionage, German officials said. It was only the second time since World War II that Germany has made public that it had sought the removal of American spies. Both cases have been in the last 2 years. And for some perspective on this, again, For the Record segment 119, and also the pair of For the Record segments called The Free Congress Foundation Goes West, World War II Redux, covers the growing friction between U.S. and German intelligence. This is indicative of growing friction between the two countries. In a program done during the Balkans War, I noted that the, quote, center-left government, unquote, of Gerhard Schroeder was, in fact, arguably the most nationalistic and idiosyncratic German government since the end of World War II, that it was profoundly anti-American, despite its lip service to the contrary, and that even as the Balkans War was getting underway, with the United States handling the bulk of the military burden, in fact, Germany was behaving in a very idiosyncratic and anti-American fashion, and one of the things I noted at that time was the formation of a European Union-wide military force, something which may very well augur poorly for the United States in the future. My prognostication in that regard is now being echoed, apparently, in the corridors of power in Washington, D.C. Evidence of that was contained in an article in the Los Angeles Times of Monday, December 6th of 1999. This is an article by John Tor Dahlberg, D-A-H-L-B-U-R-G, of the L.A. Times. It's datelined aboard the Charles de Gaulle, or Charles de Gaulle, a French aircraft carrier. It's headlined, Proposed EU Strike Force Worries U.S. It reads in part as follows, the introductory paragraph anyway, which sums up the article, reads as follows. Western Europe, which shares everything these days from a currency to regulations on hunting migratory birds, is embarking this week toward the creation of a unified military force, a prospect that has given Washington the jitters. Again, I noted the ominous prospects for Europe taking a dramatically different direction from the United States when that military force was first proposed as a distant entity or something that would take place in the distant future when Germany first brought that up when they held the rotating presidency of the European Union. In For the Record segments 186 about George W. Bush entitled What Does the W in George W. Stand For? The George W. Bush Stand For? I noted the historical connections between the Third Reich and the Underground Reich, the Bormann Group in particular, and the Bush family, and I speculated about the possibility that just as many key officials in the Bormann Group are the sons and sons-in-law of key Nazi officials and SS men, so too the possibility that George W. might be involved with the American branch of the Bormann Group, just as his father, grandfather, and great-grandfather had been allied with the pro-Nazi elements or the Third Reich itself. In For the Record segment 186, I noted that a former Undersecretary of State under George Bush when he was president was one of the top foreign policy advisors for George W. This is a German-American named Robert B. Zoellick, Z-O-E-L-L-I-C-K, who's affiliated not only with Harvard University but also with the German Marshall Fund of the United States, in effect a PR front for the Bormann Group and the German heavy industrial concerns that it is inextricably linked with. endorsement for this European Union-wide military force, something that's causing anxiety in Washington, was carried in the Financial Times of London of Monday, December 13th of 1999. And I would note that this endorsement of that proposal comes from Robert B. Zelick, who co-authored this article with a fellow named Charles Kupchan, K-U-P-C-H-A-N, a professor at Georgetown University and a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. This article is entitled, "It Can Be Lonely at the Top," and again noting the connections between Robert Zelick and George W. and the German Marshall Fund of the United States, in effect, a Bormann front group. This particular article endorsing the European-wide military union is more than a little interesting. Skipping down, Messrs. Kupchan and Zelick have to say, again from the Financial Times of London of 12/13/99, "A true European defense force will be limited in size and political weight unless Germany joins the UK and France as an equal partner. Although Germany's willingness to bear security burdens outside its borders is increasing, a full commitment to European defense will require strong leadership by a new generation of German politicians." And again, note the endorsement for the European Union-wide military force that's causing anxiety in Washington by Robert Zelick, associated with the German Marshall Fund of the United States, in effect a Bormann front group, and one of the top security foreign policy advisors, I should say, for George W. And for the full accounting of the circumstantial evidence suggesting that George W. might be the point man for the American branch of the Bormann Group and the Underground Reich, as I call it, literally a Third Reich gone underground. Reference for the record segments 186, available from Spitfire, and descriptions of all of the For the Record segments, including 186, are available on the Spitfire website. In the past, commenting on the European Monetary Union, I have noted that the centralization of the European economy under German domination is, in effect, the realization of a plan first proposed in the 1840s by pan-German theoretician and economist Friedrich Liest. Liest proposed an economically unified Europe under German domination as a vehicle for unseating Great Britain as the dominant power on Earth. Of course, the dominant power on Earth, at least for the time being, is the United States, and otherwise the Liest plan, again spelled L-I-S-T, is right on schedule, only with the United States, not Great Britain, being the number one target. I've also noted in the past that in many ways the battle lines of World War II are being redrawn with what, for lack of a better term, could be termed called Anglo-Saxonia versus Germania, with Germany and its continental allies in many ways showing growing friction in all areas with Great Britain and the United States. In a program called The Coming of the European Monetary Union, I detailed my reflections on Friedrich Liest and his proposal for an economically unified Europe under German domination as a vehicle for effecting German world conquest. A unified Europe and a fascist Europe, and this would implicitly be under German domination, has long been the focal point of post-World War II European fascism. So in addition to being an economically unified Europe, being the vehicle envisioned by Friedrich Liest and other pan-German theoreticians as a vehicle for German world conquest, we should note that a politically unified Europe under fascism has long been envisioned by post-World War II fascist theoreticians as a vehicle for not only realizing a worldwide fascist, basically fascist dictatorship, but as a vehicle for combating the Soviet Union and the United States. And these post-war theoreticians, to a large extent, viewed the United States as the greater threat. Now, of course, as I speak in January of the year 2000, the Soviet Union is history and increasingly distant history. It is the United States that is now seen as the greatest threat by this particular brand of post-World War II fascist theoreticians. The pro-pan-European and vehemently anti-American strain of this profound element of post-World War II fascism was exemplified by the Imperium text of Francis Parker Yockey. Francis Parker Yockey was an American national and one of the leading theoreticians of post-World War II fascism. His book Imperium is distributed by the Liberty Lobby, among other institutions. In For the Record segment 185, I interviewed Kevin Coogan, a brilliant researcher who has authored the definitive text about Francis Parker Yockey. That book is called Dreamer of the Day, subtitled Francis Parker Yockey and the Post-War Fascist International. It's authored by Kevin Coogan, last name C-O-O-G-A-N. It's published in softcover by Autono Media, A-U-T-O-N-O-M-E-D-I-A, copyright 1999. And you can access their website at autonomedia.org. And the ISBN number is 1-57027-039-2. And in Kevin Coogan's landmark text, Dreamer of the Day, there is discussion of the Francis Parker Yockey viewpoint that America and the Soviet Union were best combated by a unified Europe under fascism, and that this politically unified Europe, as contrasted with the Friedrich List economically unified Europe, that a politically unified Europe would be the best bet for ending American power in Europe. Francis Parker Yockey, like most of his fellow fascists, was fiercely anti-American. There's also a pro-American nationalist brand of fascism. But Francis Parker Yockey is one of the top theoreticians of post-World War II fascism, and he was bitterly anti-American. His work is profoundly influential in the contemporary fascist ranks. And Francis Parker Yockey, like the top British fascist Sir Oswald Mosley, head of the British Union of Fascists, the top British fascist organization in the pre-World War II period, Francis Parker Yockey and Mosley saw a politically unified Europe under fascism as the top vehicle for combating and ultimately destroying American influence around the world. With the forming of the European Monetary Union, growing trade friction between the United States and the EMU, and now with anxieties in Washington, as I predicted there should be, over the formation of the European Union-wide military force, the views of Francis Parker Yockey, Sir Oswald Mosley, and other fascist theoreticians fiercely anti-American, should be taken into account. And by the way, many of those fascist theoreticians sought to use the left in order to help destroy American influence, something that should be borne in mind. Of the Yockey and Oswald Mosley view that a politically unified Europe was the best vehicle for defeating American and Soviet influence, we read in Dreamer of the Day by Kevin Coogan, Mosley took his first tentative step back into politics in 1946 with My Answer, a book that denied any charge of treason. Parenthetically interrupting, Sir Oswald Mosley was interned as a traitor, basically, during World War II. Continuing, 1 year later, Mosley published his own Imperium-like opus called The Alternative. Like Yockey, he argued that the narrow nationalism of pre-war fascism was obsolete, and that a new, united Europe must be created as a third force between the Soviet threat and American capitalism. Imperium is the name of Francis Parker Yockey's top theoretical work. Again, it's distributed by the Liberty Lobby, and the Imperium, basically, the Latin word for empire, referred to a politically unified Europe under fascism. I would note that in Switzerland and Austria, among other countries, many fascist parties and many fascist elements are growing through their resistance to the notion of the European Monetary Union, which, in addition to cementing German economic power over the continent, is also fomenting fascist sentiment. And I think even though many of the fascist groups in Europe are officially, at least, anti-EMU, that could ultimately lead to the ascension of fascist parties in Europe, and then there would be an EMU and a political union and a military union of Europe under fascism, which is exactly what people like Yockey and Sir Oswald Mosley envisioned as a vehicle for basically destroying American influence around the world. Turning once again to Dreamer of the Day by Kevin Coogan, more about the fascist view of a unified Europe as a vehicle for defeating the United States. Already the idea of a united Europe could be found, quote, everywhere in the minds of the culture-bearing stratum of the West, and for a while it was actualized in its first crude provisional form during the Second World War, unquote. That, of course, is a reference to the Third Reich. The quoting here, by the way, is from Francis Parker Yockey's Imperium. Returning once again to Coogan's text, once the idea of Imperium was fully established, again quoting, no force within the civilization could resist the coming cultural reunion that would unite North and South, Teuton and Latin, Protestant and Catholic, Prussia, England, Spain, Italy, and France in the tasks now waiting, unquote. Those tasks, viewed by Yockey, Mosley, and others as defeating Soviet communism and American capitalism. More about the fascist view of a united Europe. The enthusiasm for, reading again from Coogan's text, the enthusiasm for Imperium reflected a strongly felt need for a new kind of fascism. The call for a united Europe was also being forcefully articulated by Sir Oswald Mosley. In The European Situation, The Third Force, Mosley commented, quote, in 1948, I stated the policy, Europe a nation, because it seemed to me at this point in history that to be both the deep desire of the European and the practical necessity of the present situation, unquote. Again, I've stated that the current, quote, center-left government of Gerhard Schröder, in my view, was quite simply a front. I believe Joschka Fischer, a Green member of parliament who was the leading figure in the German peace movement and who then metamorphosed into a leading German hawk with regard to the Balkans War, is BND, and I think that quite simply this government, this, quote, center-left government in Germany, the most nationalistic government Germany has ever had in the post-war period, is quite simply a front and was, in effect, maneuvered into power when international outrage over the reemergence of German fascism and the sorry state of human rights in Germany with regard to minorities basically registered on the German political seismograph. I would note in this regard that in 1993, the UN was actually debating about the possibility of sending peacekeeping troops to Germany in order to basically help to stabilize the human rights situation and to neutralize Nazi attacks on minorities. That within 3 years of German reunification. Again, as I've noted in past programs, the Schröder government is the most nationalistic government Germany has ever had and is acting in from an economic and political standpoint, is an imperial fashion, and in many ways, under this center-left front, the Imperium is being realized. The research credit on the following goes to a member of the listening audience. Listen to this story very carefully. This is an AP story, datelined Berlin, and it's from December 28th of 1999. And the Associated Press headlined this story, Schröder to Europe, Unite versus U.S. The article reads in part as follows. Europe must act more like a single country if it wants to challenge U.S. economic and political dominance, Chancellor Gerhard Schröder said Tuesday. Asked in a television interview whether the United States lacked consideration for its allies, Schröder said, quote, yes, that certainly is so. Still quoting, there is a risk of America looking inward because of its huge economic power and its huge political weight, and it would be regrettable if that process continues, unquote. By the way, I would agree with that part of the analysis, but listen to the rest of this. But European nations have to do their part by uniting behind common goals, Schröder said, noting the 15-nation European Union's decision this year to appoint a senior diplomat as a first step toward a hoped-for joint foreign policy. Again, quoting, whining about U.S. dominance doesn't help. We have to act, unquote, Schröder said in the interview with Phoenix Public TV. Again, this article, Schröder to Europe, Unite versus U.S. from the AP of December 28, 1999, and a tip of the hat to a listener for this very important article. Just imagine if the Premier of China or Mr. Putin in Russia said basically Europe or Asia must unite versus the United States. Can you imagine the headlines? Noting in that regard the similarity in pronouncements between, quote, center-left politician Gerhard Schröder and people like Francis Parker Yockey and Sir Oswald Mosley. I've noted in numerous programs that the German goal in World War II with regard to conquest, as it was devised by the major German corporate leaders, was to have a corporatist approach to conquest. Basically, after German military forces had subdued countries around the world, their economies would then be subjugated to the German corporations, which would then enter world markets from that dominant position. I've noted also in the past about the German domination of the European economy, which was effected during the Second World War and cemented in the post-war period, including and especially as a result of the actions of the Bormann Flight Capital Organization, literally the economic component of a Third Reich gone underground. That's something I've spoken about in numerous programs. It would take quite a long time to detail that in the present context. Suffice it to say that the Underground Reich and the Bormann Group, literally a Third Reich gone underground, envisions and has utilized German corporations as vehicles for national and fascist conquest. Whereas American corporations seek basically, and this is something of a simple oversimplification, but it's basically accurate, low labor costs and lax environmental regulations, either in the United States or elsewhere, in order to maximize profits. Outside of that relatively narrow consideration, American corporations are basically apolitical, and they do not act as a vehicle for American nationalism. German corporations, on the other hand, have been acting in a coordinated, unified fashion and as vehicles for German nationalist conquest, and basically they have acted in an altogether coordinated fashion, not unlike the way NATO military forces attacked Yugoslavia during the Balkans War. Some planes would take out roadways, others would take out bridges or railways, others would attack energy centers such as petroleum dumps and refineries, others would attack media outlets and television stations. This is not to endorse that, but rather it was a coordinated plan of assault. This is how German corporations have been functioning in the 1990s in the wake of German reunification. In our visits with Professor Stauffer of Stauffer Consultants, we saw how German corporations began behaving much as the German military did, obviously without the bloodshed. Basically, they were moving into Eastern Europe and buying up energy, communications, transportation, and heavy strategic industry, functioning, again, these individual German corporations, functioning as elements of a coordinated whole, and realizing Friedrich Liszt's theory, which is that basically economic control led automatically to political control. And this is the difference between the German corporatist approach and the way American corporations behave. It is fundamental. And I would note again that the Schrader government is the most nationalistic and chauvinistic government, despite its center-left trappings in the post-World War II period. And I would note that while German corporations have been buying up critical corporate properties in other countries, it is still a matter of German law that the German core corporations, such as Daimler-Benz or Siemens or Volkswagen, cannot have a controlling interest in them owned by a foreign country. This despite the fact that German corporations own a controlling interest in many powerful corporate elements around the world. I've noted, for example, in For the Record segments 122, 123, 177, and 189, that German corporations and behind those, the Bormann Flight Capital Organization, have developed effective control over American publishing. I would note that when the British Vodafone Corporation, the largest mobile phone company in Great Britain, made a hostile bid to take over Mannesmann, a German heavy industrial concern which is now moving into communications from its traditional field of manufacturing and steel, that the Vodafone takeover of Mannesmann is being fiercely resisted by virtually all segments of German society, whereas German corporate takeovers have been acquiesced, or basically foreign countries have acquiesced with regard to German corporate takeovers. The Financial Times of London of November 20th and November 21st of 1999 had the following story by Peter Tall Larson, Ralph Atkins, Haig Simonian, and Alan Kane. Its headline, German Chancellor Weighs into Battle Over Mannesmann. It's subtitled, Schrader Leads Defense with Comments Against Hostile Bids. Gerhard Schröder, the German chancellor, yesterday intervened in the $120 billion euro, or $123.6 billion takeover battle between Vodafone, AirTouch, and Mannesmann, declaring that hostile bids destroyed the culture, unquote, of the target company. In an implicit warning to Vodafone, Mr. Schröder said hostile bidders in German companies, quote, underestimate the virtue of co-determination, workers' representation in the boardroom. I would note that when Deutsche Telekom and Mannesmann bought two of the largest of the British mobile phone companies, 1&1 and Orange, there was no protest raised either by British politicians or the corporate leaders of those countries. This contrasts very dramatically with the extremely chauvinistic and nationalistic way that Germany has behaved with regard to a British takeover of a major German corporation. Turning now to the Financial Times of Tuesday, November 23rd of 1999, this is another article by Ralph Atkins and Haig Simonian in Berlin, and in addition to Gerhard Schröder, Hans Eichel, Germany's finance minister, has also railed against the Vodafone takeover, potential takeover of Mannesmann. Again, the Financial Times of London, 11/23/99. This is headlined, Germany calls for new rules to govern European takeovers, and it reads in part as follows. Hans Eichel, Germany's finance minister, yesterday called for new takeover rules in Europe to avoid a culture clash between Anglo-American capitalism and the consensual German model. His comments follow Vodafone AirTouch's record €124 billion or $128 billion hostile bid for Mannesmann, which has alarmed Germany's political establishment on the right and the left. Again, note that not only the finance minister, but the prime minister of Germany, the chancellor of Germany, I should say, Schröder, have railed against and have actively weighed against Vodafone's takeover of Mannesmann. The political and economic leadership in the United States has not been, in Great Britain and elsewhere around the world, has not behaved in that fashion with regard to German corporate takeovers. We're going to continue this discussion in the next half-hour segment. The various half-hour segments that I've alluded to, as well as the archive shows, tapes of the various lectures that I've given over the years, are available from a tape duplication service called Spitfire. That's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. They're located at P.O. Box 1179. That's Post Office Box 1179. That's in Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. The email address for Spitfire is spitfire@ix.netcom.com. That's spitfire@ix.netcom.com. There's a list of and description of the tapes available from Spitfire on the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. That's S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E-L-I-S-T. Spitfirelist.com is equipped with real audio so that listeners can listen to the tape segments going out to the stations that carry this program during the week that they are going out. There's also a list of the various programs available from Spitfire on the KFJC website. That's at kfjc.org. Look in the Transmissions and Public Affairs sections, and the kfjc.org website has the various tape references linked so that listeners can simply click on those references and go directly to those tapes. I have an email address at which listeners can reach me. It's demory@kfjc.org. demory@kfjc.org. Please note that I do not have time to respond to correspondence. It's simply a matter of time. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.